for joining us. We are recording today's podcast from our remote locations in Columbus, Ohio and Ann Arbor, Michigan. My name is Tanya Burkhardt, and I'm a doctoral candidate at The Ohio State University. I'm thrilled to talk with Dr. Yoso today. Our conversation is entitled The Role of Social Context in Educational Research, Contemporary Directions, Goals, and Issues. Division G's Vice President, Dr. Moji, has recently stated the following: "Now more than ever, the world needs research that sheds light on how social contexts matter in learning, teaching, student achievement, and in the development of equitable and just forms and systems of education. The demand for more and better research on social contexts is necessitated by a host of challenges and changes in our world, including the alarming growth in income disparity in the U.S., persistent racial, ethnic, sexual, gender, linguistic, and social class inequalities across local, national, and global contexts, differential access to information, demands for teachers to be accountable to prescribed practices and mandated curricula, and by calls to turn around or overturn the nature and structure of public education." Today, we look forward to delving even further into these issues with an educational researcher who has been doing exemplary work in this arena, Dr. Terry Yoso. Dr. Yoso, if you like, please introduce yourself, your area of scholarship, and a little bit about your association with Division G.
I am really excited to be here with you this afternoon. I appreciate this opportunity to talk with graduate students and specifically talk with graduate students who are interested in better understanding the social context of the multiple communities that we work with. So thank you for this invitation to share with you a little bit of who I am and what guides my work. I originally grew up in Northern California, which was hella cool. I am from San Jose, California, and I went to public schools. My parents kept us on what is known as the south side of San Jose, and that is known for being the predominantly white and Asian part of the city and upper middle class. And I'm not sure how much it has changed today, but that did not occur, of course, on accident. My family are not from San Jose, but they, when we relocated there, went through a great deal of, we were the only renters on the block. I come from a very working class family, but they wanted to keep us on that side. And in their understanding, that's where the good schools were. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of learning by going to school with peers who had parents with college educations was important for my parents, because neither of them had an opportunity to go to college. And so as a first generation college student myself, while I can have some contradictory feelings about where they put me in school and what kinds of access and equity issues other folks on the east side, on the northeast side in particular of San Jose, did not have access to, I appreciate the sacrifice that they made because it did make a difference. So that is the first part of what gets me interested in the social context of education. It is my own personal experience with growing up very working class, being, I'm of a much lighter shade of brown, as you can see from the picture, but being one of the only students of color in a classroom, coming to my own identity in processes and practices of education, did not really occur in a political way until I got to UCLA. But if we step back slightly, I was, as a high school student, working on the east side of San Jose, volunteering in a program for youth. And that is where I met a family who I dedicate my first book to eventually. But that family of 10 kids were being failed at every single level of the pipeline. And it was shocking, sad, disturbing, and really motivating for me to encounter this family and to make you know, close friendships with this, with each of the kids in this family. The kindergartner was placed, for example, this is a mixed documented family. So they were from Mexico. Half of the family had documents. Half of the family did not have documents. They were living in a very economically impoverished area, but they were one of the hardest working families that I knew. All of the children participated in one way or another in contributing. There was a lot of community cultural wealth in the area and also evident in the family. The kindergartner, however, was placed in school where he did not speak Spanish, but he was placed in ESL. There was a junior high school student who had not yet learned how to read. The third grade student who was still struggling with basic recognition of numbers and addition and subtraction. The 10th grade student who had been flunked twice and then was put in the educable mentally retarded classes and got in so many fights for being called stupid that he left school. And the first to graduate from high school who had a lot of friends who were essays, but did not know how to write one. And this experience for me as a high school student helped me to see that there were structures that were completely disrespectful to the family and what they brought to the situation. The high school student who was working at a pizza place, someone said, you know, why, how, when you are applying to community college, you know, how is it that you're bringing me your parents' taxes and what, how do you survive like on this amount of money? And he says, some days we eat and some days we don't. Mm-hmm. And that he would bring home, he would sometimes order pizzas and then bring home the extras because nobody picked them up, you know, if you know what I mean. So mm-hmm. this was very foundational to some of my thinking in going to UCLA. We had at my high school, even though it was on the quote better side of town, in meaning the more white and Asian part of town, the more upper middle class part of town, we only had 5 AP courses. And of those, I was only eligible to take 2 because one was English and one was history. And I graduated with a 3.8 GPA, but when you weighted the honors and the AP, I had a 4.2 and I graduated number 5 from my high school. I was never identified as a college bound student. We did not have a college counselor. We did not have someone who reaching out to me saying you should apply for scholarships, but I was one of 3 students who applied and got into UCLA. And when other students found out that I was going to UCLA, the comment was, oh my God, you're going to UCLA. You only got in because you're Puerto Rican. Oh. And my response was, I'm Puerto Rican. What? No. And I was very confused about how and why someone would jump to that conclusion when I myself was barely rediscovering a lot of the history of my family and how that was violently and in many ways erased. And in my recovery process at UCLA, my first class that I took that really introduced me to understanding the school system better, as a sophomore, I took Mexican Americans in the schools. And that was taught by Daniel Solorzano. This was the second year that he taught that class. And that put me on a trajectory of really understanding what it means to critique the structures of schooling as a central way in which racism replicates itself in society, and not to see schools as a peripheral or merely a reflection of the larger society, but rather also playing a really central role in that process.
Thank you so much for this explanation and these stories, especially. And while you were telling the story of the family you described earlier, you mentioned the concept of community cultural wealth, which I think is one of your main contributions to the field. Could you talk a little bit about the concept itself, how you define it, and how you developed it?
Sure. When I was a graduate student, the way that Solorzano mentors, it took me like 6 years working with him before he was like, Tara, you can call me Danny. I was like, okay, are you sure? This is, you know, how to breathe deep on that one. And so the way that he mentors is just with such generosity that he is always reminding us to try to account for those who have come before us, both in the community and scholarly traditions that have come before us, and to carry those traditions on. And in doing that, he's really always encouraged his students and me, as one of his students, to think about all of those knowledges that we bring to the situation. When you are an undergraduate, when you are a graduate student, in these places and spaces that are historically white, that are very elite, that are very alienating in many cases, it often destabilizes you and you begin to feel a lot of self-doubt, as some of the literature talks about. And you begin to feel the imposter syndrome, as some of the literature talks about. And yet you have, as Audre Lorde talks about, this anger about the inability of these frameworks that are available, these explanations, these theories, to explain what is actually happening in your community, in your world, in what matters to you, in the realities that we know on a daily basis, in communities of color, in working class communities, in classrooms, outside of classrooms, that really shape a much more complex way of understanding the world. And yet you feel that you have no right to contribute to explain what's happening and why. So I think that for me, that is really huge, that he really kind of pushed me first to see that I have something to contribute. His class, Mexican Americans in the Schools, was the first Chicana and Chicano Studies class that I took. I was also on campus at UCLA during the hunger strike for the departmentalization of Chicana and Chicano Studies. And that was very influential in my coming to political consciousness. In addition to the hunger strike, there were marches, there were all kinds of visitors who came to our campus, such as Farrakhan, such as the Brown Berets, such as the FBI, you know, there was pushback, there were vigils, really kind of supportive and challenging moments to learn and to come to understand that our presence on our campus and our knowledges on our campuses are very political and are considered threatening to the status quo. So for me, that is really where it begins in how it is that we come to these, that bell hooks talks about. Presence is a disruption to these places and spaces that are often hostile. And she's talking specifically about Black working class students being a disruption on historically white campuses. And I would argue that looking at Chicana and Chicano experiences, looking at Filipina and Filipino experiences, looking at the multiplicity of our experiences, especially working class, first generation, college students of color, I think that there are ways in which we have been made to feel that we have nothing to contribute and we should be so lucky as to be on the campus. And instead of really recognizing those who fought so that we could be there, and not so just so that we could be there, but so that we could contribute with our knowledge and produce new knowledge, knowledge that is grounded in the histories and the urgent needs that remain in our communities. So in light of that, as an assistant professor, I went and did a presentation with Danny at AERA that was focused on this community cultural wealth concept that actually he and Octavio Villalpando initially allude to in another chapter. And they were talking about marginalized students and the cultural assets that they bring to the campus and the insights that they can provide, but that they're not just there to provide those insights to white students as a form of diversifying the campus, that they are there to produce new knowledges and to be centered in those discussions as not like the talking monkey in the room kind of a thing, mm-hmm. but as the as someone who is there as a scholar. And so I think that basically I took that concept, and Danny and I were confronted in a room of 100 people. There was a lot of, you know, positivity at AERA. That positivity also comes across as like critique. And so we were told, you know, don't be naive. When you are identifying that there are cultural assets in your community, those are going to be taken and those are going to be co-opted. Don't be naive that, you know, there are not, we've also been critiqued that there are real issues in our communities. If you're just focusing on like the positive knowledge that comes out of our community, being really naive about the negative things that happen in our communities. So what happened is that, Danny and I had been talking and in conversation, and that's how most of our work came about, in dialogue, very much in the Paulo Freirean sense of in dialogue and critical reflection. And he told me to take that concept and run with it. And so I did. We had at that time, I think, just a couple ideas about community cultural wealth. And we did kind of like a collective dialogue with a group of mujeres, Latinas. I think it was called the Latinas in Education. There was an acronym there. So in dialogue, we created these different kind of initial areas. And then I took the paper and spent a couple months, probably, I'm not sure, but I basically, what I was trying to acknowledge there were that we have knowledge that schools either recognize and refuse to incorporate into what they will assess us on, but like there has been some amazing work done about the SAT. I believe that the author's name is Posner, P-O-S-N-E-R. And he talks about the ways in which whenever African-Americans and Latinas and Latinos would do well on an SAT question, they would take that question off the exam for the next time around on those test questions. And so this idea that we really are less than and inferior to, it's very built into the critique that Bourdieu launches against the educational and social system. And so I think one of the main problems that I have encountered so far with the concept of community cultural wealth is, first, there is a contentious relationship with the concept of capital itself. I put it like an end note in there. And whenever I write about it, I talk about, you know, the concept of capital is really problematic, especially, you know, in a capitalist society. And so I use this with the caveat of saying, I'm trying to express to you that these forms of knowledge, skills, abilities, networks are valuable, that they come from struggle, that they come from a place of being relegated to the margins. And then as bell hooks talks about using the margin as a site of resistance. And as Gloria Anzaldúa talks, you know, really asserting ourselves, not just in response to, Gloria Anzaldúa talks about, you can't just stand on the opposite end of the riverbanks shouting at each other forever. Mm-hmm. Once you have new knowledge, she also says, like, knowledge is painful. You can't just keep responding and reacting in the same way. The possibilities are endless, she says, when you decide to act and not just react. And for me, all of that was, that's the other contentious, complicated, contradictory component, is there was a conversation that we had very early on amongst this group of Latinas and with Danny and myself about my push was, why can't we just have community cultural wealth? And Danny's push is like, yeah, that would be a pushback. You know, that would be nice. Except for the fact that we have this thing called racism. Like, we can't necessarily just go back in time and say, like, you know, okay, you burned all of our books when you got here, you know, like, what was it like? The only ways in which we know what life was like before the soldiers arrived, you know, is to understand that through their very eyes, like 60 years later, 70 years later, when folks would begin to recover this. And so what are the ways in which we can recover some of these knowledges? It's by actually thinking about, in critical reflection, the communities themselves and the way that they carry on these traditions. And so it's to stop focusing on the ways in which the colonizers, those white conceptions of us, and trying to live up to those conceptions, which is what Bourdieu says, that's what schools do. That's what the formal education and what very elitist families do. They pass on these very limited access forms of knowledge to each other, and schools test us on those limited forms of knowledge. Those knowledges, those networks, the ability to form those leadership skills are not granted to folks of color. And instead of looking at the leadership models that we have leadership models all around us on an everyday basis, and people in our communities and in our parents. And so I think that is shifting that lens to recognize that we don't need to be held to that standard, and to identify that standard as something that someone else held up for us. Bourdieu was critiquing the ways in which hierarchy replicates itself. Why on earth would we try to perpetuate that as our model of how to do school? He was laying out for us a really important critique of the ways in which we are pitted against each other to compete over limited access to these forms of knowledge. Why wouldn't we share the forms of knowledge that we have? Well, we do in our communities. We have multiple examples of the ways in which we share community cultural wealth on an everyday basis. And that is the whole purpose of the article, which I think is why it's resonated so much. It's not because I'm so awesome or it's because of all of the amazing literatures and scholars that you see in all of those footnotes and all of those endnotes. Each form of community cultural wealth, there's entire bodies of scholarship who have been helping us understand familial capital, for example, in the funds of knowledge scholarship, of the ways in which farm workers and farm worker families pass on knowledges about moon cycles, about soil acidity, about pesticides, about the healing power of plants, about hard work ethic. All of this happens in our families. What it means to be una persona bien educada, a person who has integrity and respect and high moral standards and honesty. Rebecca Burciaga has written about this in her dissertation, the way that we pass on these aspirations. So I think that's really what inspired and why that article has taken off in that way, because it points out what was a glaring tendency towards, we keep challenging the deficit thinking of our communities just don't have enough. They just are never quite making the mark, that there's this achievement gap, etc. And we have not fully challenged and questioned who is holding up that litmus test, who is holding up that marker. It's not necessarily, as many scholars have pointed out, it's not an achievement gap, it's an opportunity gap. And so there are ways in which just shifting that lens to actually focus on the strengths, assets, and wealth that our cultures have to sustain us through racism, through multiple forms of subordination, how we survive with very limited access to what others take for granted on an everyday basis, and how instead of just surviving, we resist and we challenge and we thrive. And on the other hand, you know, you also don't want to be like, woohoo, we survive even though we had racism, so keep it up. You know, I think that that's why I added the whole, you know, beginning section of that paper, which I don't know that, that all folks, I don't know that folks see that you cannot have community cultural wealth without acknowledging critical race theory in education, that that's really where it comes out of. Because community cultural wealth does not just stand as a concept, as a model, as a framework for understanding a different way to go about doing school without understanding that critical race theory came in as an intervention that came from the law, that came as a disruption to the status quo of how we do research, how we consider policy, how we approach our pedagogy, what we are thinking about methodologically, how we are going to capture, account for the persistent and permanent, as Derek Bell talks about, role of racism as it shapes education in our society.
So I'm glad you're talking about critical race theory. Just thinking about the theory itself, and could you talk a little bit about how you came to using this theory in particular, and if there are any challenges that you encountered with applying the theory to non-Black, white, binary forms of racism?
That, I think that's a great question. I did encounter a lot of pushback, as did Danny. We came out with critical race theory in terms of like we as like a collective of people kind of working in different places and spaces across the U.S. and different institutions. There were not many of us applying this at the time to education from the law and trying to figure out what this movement could and should look like. We didn't set out to say like we're going to do a movement, you know, but I think that in the law, it clearly was a movement. And I think that we were very captivated by the power of centering a concept that in our very conservative field of education that claims to be often not so conservative. And in the case of where I went to graduate school at UCLA, they claimed a very social justice focus, but it did not have that because it did not have this clear focus on challenging racism at its intersections with other forms of subordination. And I think that that's where folks at the time in the 90s were very few voices that were not white and male that were cited all the time about critical pedagogy. And I think that those voices that who were white and male and who still are wonderful scholars, amazing contributions, and very important interventions into our thinking about schools. But we really wanted to center the voices of scholars of color, of people of color, in every aspect of what we did. And so I think that we were very explicit about that process. We took every article and made sure that it would be a standalone so that it would not be presumed or that the quote data would speak for itself. We understand that data don't speak for themselves. We always interpret them, and that my definition of race and racism may not be how you're understanding that concept. And so as a reader, I want to make sure that I'm understanding where the scholar is coming from. And as a scholar, I want to make sure that my readers know how I'm defining my terms. And so defining and operationalizing these terms was very important. Acknowledging that we're not the first ones to make these critiques and to really point folks in various directions as to where they can gain more resources and more readings and to give them a better insight into what our intellectual journey was to critical race theory and how that it's also informed by community traditions outside of scholarly traditions and how important that is to our thinking and that that is a strength to our research, not a weakness. All of those were pushback points. So when we put forward an article, some of the reviews that we would get back would be around those types of issues. No one knew at that point what a counterstory was. They were very unfamiliar with racial microaggressions and the work of Chester Pierce, and very unfamiliar with, and one of our pieces that we did around experiences in graduate school, it comes out in the International Journal of Qualitative Studies in Education, and it is counter storytelling Chicana and Chicano graduate school experiences, actually. And the first part of it is critical race and lack crit theory and method, I think. And so that piece had its own journey. After 6 months, we got a revise and resubmit from Harvard Educational Review, and then we resubmitted it for consideration, and then 6 months later, they rejected it. Then we sent it to the Journal of Qualitative Inquiry, and they wouldn't even send it out for review. They also rejected the piece and said, but when you have something that's methodological, send it to us. And so then we finally sent it to the International Journal of Qualitative Studies in Education, and we got another revise and resubmit. And some of these reviews are, of course, you know, condescending and just ignorant about some of the literatures. What we ended up producing in that piece, we put an appendix of readings that helped us form the arguments there. And so we had our own references of what we cited throughout the piece, but we also put an appendix of readings on resistance by women of color. And part of that was because of the process that we were getting so much pushback about, like, who we had cited and why we had cited certain folks that they were unfamiliar with, that the reviewers weren't familiar with, or the concepts that we needed to more fully define. In the end, I think that the piece is much stronger for having gone through all of these iterations. And I think that Danny's persistence and reassurance that, you know, this place will find its home, I feel really good about us holding strong to what we were willing to do, what we were not willing to do. But I think that focusing on Chicanas and Chicanos, it was unique for too many reviewers, especially because it's not like in the 90s that was something, you know, that just arrived to the scene. But it tells you kind of like as a state of affairs, talking about racism and Chicanas and Chicanos and using a counter story to embody the themes of the data and to pose challenging questions to the field, that some places weren't ready for it at that time. What was ironic in the end is that we did end up putting forward a piece to Qualitative Inquiry that's always been like in their top 10 or 15 articles ever since, which is critical race methodology, counter storytelling as a form of an educational research or something like that. That is the title. And so that piece, what we did out of frustration and out of, like, Spanish, you say toma, like, you know, like kind of like ya ves, like now you see, now you hear me. I put like a big section of the piece that they originally rejected as an example of a counter story so that they did end up publishing our piece. I think that some of the pushback that I also received as a junior scholar going up for tenure was really difficult. I went to a UC and I was in Department of Chicana and Chicano Studies. I was there for 15 years at UC Santa Barbara. When I was hired, of course, they were very laudatory about my work. And in my, you know, first year review, very, you know, everything is laudatory in terms of when you're reading those remarks. At my fourth year review, by that time, they had told me you can't go up with articles, you need a book. And so I had to really switch gears midstream. And they also had changed their mind about whether or not they liked counter stories. And they said, who do you think you are, Sandra Cisneros or Toni Morrison? You know, like you are not a scholar of that caliber to be able to do counter stories. That's not real social science. And so obviously, these are political places and spaces, and some people do not recognize the ways in which they replicate the same hierarchy that they confronted, and they become the very same gatekeepers that they also wish in their, you know, in their own experience they had not had such horrible confrontations with. And so, you know, knowing the work of Paulo Freire and others, when he talks about that the oppressed often become the oppressor in many situations, and knowing the ways in which racism plays itself out in horrible ways on each of our psyche, and that we often lash out at each other as people of color and hold ourselves up to the same litmus tests that we were held to, as opposed to opening the doors wider for each other. Mm-hmm. That this is a really unfortunate consequence and outcome of racism and of being in an institution in which you begin to believe and participate and be a vested interest in upholding the status quo, as opposed to being who you are and remembering where you come from and trying to open the doors to make sure that more of those who are from where you are from, and ideologically, politically, economically, socially, culturally, that they have those same opportunities, so that we don't become, you have to think exactly like me, but rather I have complex ideas and so do you. So that doesn't mean that we can't agree to disagree on certain things. That doesn't mean that you should not be here at the university. It means this is a place where we can bring really incredible ideas, contest those ideas, and present them in ways that we believe are going to be accessible to the communities that we would like to converse with. And for me, that's why I do counter stories, is to try to make theory and data more accessible. If I'm going to talk about community cultural wealth, I can do so in academic prose. I've demonstrated that, but I would like to in some way honor the women who every day are engaging in those struggles on behalf of their children, of the men who are doing that on behalf of their children, on behalf of their communities. And so that was why I put that in my chapter 2 of the Critical Race Counter Stories Along the Chicana and Chicano Educational Pipeline, because there are multiple associations of parents who work with the strengths that they have in their communities. Concha Delgado Gaitan wrote about this in 1992, as schooling matters in the Mexican American home. And to center those voices, I did not, I guess, anticipate how threatening that is to folks who have sometimes had that communication cut off. Mm-hmm. Have lost those ties, do not see themselves anymore as reflected in those communities, or it may be too painful to look at. But I did not anticipate those kinds of pushbacks that I received. But I think that it ended up strengthening my work and my resolve to continue to do counter stories, because I looked to the scholars who had already done it, Richard Delgado and Derek Bell in particular. Although I appreciated the accusal of me being a Toni Morrison or Sandra Cisneros, I was like, I'm not even like close to, you know, being at that level, but thank you. Actually, what I was trying to do is, and then I laid out what I was trying to do. I looked at the work of Margaret Montoya, and I really talked about the power of counter storytelling in our communities and communities of color. I looked at the work of Robert Williams and talked about in indigenous communities, what the role of storytelling is. I even took some ideas that I tried to acknowledge the work of Luis Valdez with El Teatro Campesino. And I think that pushed me to really think more about our oral traditions and how counter stories are one way that we in academia are trying to bring some of those amazing components of who we are and who our communities are through time, and put that into this setting, which is an academic setting. And we don't always do it successfully, because we're also talking to an academic audience, and we're also trying to demonstrate, you know, models and theories and, you know, talk about literature, et cetera. But I think that the effort to bring that creativity, to bring those voices, to bring those histories and that those as critical reflections of who we are as a people and to connect us together, I think that part has been so healing for me as well. and it really has sustained me in the academy.
Thank you so much for this. I think that throughout when you were speaking, there were so many gems and pieces of advice or things that can count as advice for graduate students that I heard. But is there anything final that you could say to graduate students who are going through the process of working with social context and potentially experiencing some of the pushback or the difficulties that come with this field?
Well, I do want to say that eventually I was published twice in the Harvard Educational Review, and it was on my terms, in terms of, like, you do take the reviewer feedback, you're willing mm-hmm. to make the, you know, the changes to speak to your audience in different ways, but it feels much better than compromising your integrity. So what I would say is be fearless. I would say you are only limited by your own self. That these are really false limits that are placed out there. You really have to hold on to who you are. We know this from the research that high school students who have a strong sense of cultural identity are doing better in school. It's not about the whole idea of being held to someone else's standard and acting white. That has been debunked. And so the scholars who have found that the most successful students in high school are those who really have held on to who they are. And I think that for some reason, we forget that when we get to college. Sometimes we even hold on to it during undergraduate, even more so. And then when we get to graduate school, it's such a painful socialization process that I think that we need to remind ourselves to be fearless in our thinking and know that we carry on traditions of very strong women and men who also made mistakes, but are willing to get back up, dust themselves off, and keep going. And I think that their struggles are really fire for us to keep us going. And that should be part of our motivation to put their voices front and center, to not buy into the competition that is graduate school. When you're pushed to think of original research ideas and how are you going to contribute, to not take the road that others have taken, but to blaze your path and to really think about the ways in which you are doing your due diligence by seeing who else has looked at this before and how the insights of your communities, how your personal insights contribute to that. But it doesn't mean that every dissertation is going to be all about you. It also means that you are part of something much bigger, and to see yourself as not alone, and to see yourself as being part of this larger struggle. And we each put our little granito de arena, you know, that we each put our little grain of salt, of dirt, of sand, whatever you put in there, and someone's going to come and rub that. And that's what becomes that eventual diamond. And it's little pieces of really shiny, important information that comes from years of struggle and hard work, and that no one else would have thought of it in the same way as you. So when someone tells you it has to be original, I really would hope that you would not think about that as telling you that you have nothing to offer, but rather for you to dig deeper to figure out what you have to say and why it's important to the academy. And that is very much, even if your research has nothing to do with you as a person, in your mind, it really does, because it's all of those moments when you were told that you are not going to get there, that you're not going to make it. Some of my research looks at that as the motivational factor of proving them wrong. And that's some of what my dissertation did, and what some of my concept of resilient resistance that I'm still kind of pushing to get out there. It's really thinking about how can I honor the trajectory of those who got me here. I didn't do this alone. I didn't get here alone. Someone taught me how to read, right? That might have been a little far from where I am now, but I still can think about what that means and how I'm going to go forward. What would I want that woman who taught me how to read, what would I want her to know about where I am now? What would my parents say who were so proud of me when I was, you know, reading in English, even though they didn't speak English? They were just so excited about that. What would they say about the kind of work that I'm doing now? And who am I speaking to, and why am I doing that? And the ability to kind of continue to speak to multiple audiences about the importance of the work that we do is huge. I think that in your fearlessness, you hold on to who you are, maintain your integrity. And as the National Colored Women's Association was started in the 1800s, talked about, you know, we keep lifting as we climb.
Thank you so much for this amazing podcast. On behalf of the Division G Executive Committee, I just wanted to say we appreciate your work so much and look forward to reading your work more. Thank you.